The Jericho Network on Westwood One.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
Welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the pod of thunder and rock and roll. All right, Duff is laying another one on us. Will it be an egg or will it be a pot of gold? I guess we're going to find out with Duff McKagan's joke of the week. Here we go.
Hey, Chris Jericho, it's Duff McKagan calling you. Hope you're good. I got a little issue. My neighbor came at me aggressively yesterday. She's asking me if I knew anything about her underwear disappearing from the clothesline. I almost shit her panties. Thank you very much. Bye.
I like that one, actually. It's pretty funny. It's good, especially with his dry Duff delivery. The triple D trademarked. Duff, check this out, has not missed calling in a joke of the week since August of 2017 when we started this. Not even when he was in the Philippines with Guns N' Roses or a Christmas vacation with his family. He still called him in. He is a super brother, and even though Guns N' Roses are taking a break from the road right now, Duff is still crazy busy. He's got a solo album coming out this year that he wrote in lieu of writing another book. He wanted to write about his experiences with Guns N' Roses, so he wrote a solo album about it. And he's also been working on that record with Shooter Jennings, of course, Waylon Jennings' son. I'm sure he'll do more with Walking Papers. He did Cover Up over New Year's. Duff is a busy guy. He loves playing rock and roll, maybe even a new Loaded record with ex-Fozzy bass player Jeff Rouse. Lots of stuff coming up from Duff, and of course the eternal question, anything more from Guns N' Roses? Maybe we'll find out. But most importantly, coming up from Duff, more jokes of the week for 2019. So I guess you guys, as we move on, have heard all the big news about All Elite Wrestling, and I just want you to know that next Wednesday I'm going to tell you the entire story from soup to nuts on how I ended up going from WWE to New Japan to All Elite Wrestling and the plans that we have from this new company. And it's going to be a great, great year for all Chris Jericho fans, all wrestling fans in 2019. So stay tuned for that on Wednesday. But for today on the show, one of the hottest superstars in the WWE, the WWE's newest main eventer, newest top guy, Mustafa Ali. And he's telling the story of his unbelievable meteoric rise from 205 Live to the main roster, like in the past 3 weeks, how he became one of the biggest WWE superstars and a new top guy almost overnight. He's also talking about his other gig that he did before he was wrestling, which was being a Chicago police officer before his days wrestling full-time. Got some crazy stories about what that was like. Enough of my yakking. Let's just get to it with Mustafa Ali. You're going to love this conversation right here, right now on Talk is Jericho. All right, so WWE, a very awesome place and a very, not strange, but sometimes you'll see a guy just get the proverbial rocket attached to his ass in a very short time. And that's what happened to Mustafa Ali, who's here with us today, the brand new main eventer on the WWE roster, seemingly out of nowhere.
Yeah, that's quite an introduction. I just kind of showed up, huh? And the second week, what, I pinned the WWE champion, Daniel Bryan? Yeah, rocket right on the back. I have no idea how or why, but here we are.
So tell me, because you've been working 205 Live for a couple years, and like I said, this happens sometimes. It happens to almost everybody at some point when, if you're putting on good matches and working hard, one day Vince will walk past the monitor and see something and go, geez, why aren't we pushing this guy? I mean, what was it like for you? How were you told? What happened?
So honestly, I didn't know anything. Like you said, I've been working 205 since its inception. And like, it wasn't that like Vince was ignoring the product. It was 205, you know? So
right.
The situation with us is like we're always put in a tough spot, but he does see and he does hear about it. And I've had conversations with him about me, about 205. So it wasn't that he wasn't just aware, like all of a sudden, like, who the hell is this guy? You know, but literally I come to the arena and initially it was like, hey, you're not working 205 tonight. And I knew that because I was talking to the writer before. And I was actually told like, hey, you're going to have a few weeks off. We just don't have anything for you on TV for 205. So I'm thinking, all right, I got the next 3 to 4 weeks off, probably start of the new year, I'll be doing something. So I'm kind of showing up at TV just hanging out. And they're like, hey, you're working SmackDown tonight. I go, oh, okay. They go, and you're working Daniel Bryan, and you have a promo with him too, and it's three segments. I'm like, okay. And I'm kind of blowing off this writer. I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, yeah. He goes, no, I'm being serious. Like, they need you, you know, right now. Like, go. I'm like, is he confusing me for somebody? Like, what is going on? And then I find out, and that day I'm told, hey, this is just a one-time deal. We kind of want to see what happens with it, but, you know, it's just a one-time deal. We're going to give 205 to Rob. Brian wants to work with you. So it was all, I was obviously honored, you know? And I went out there, and I did my thing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I was told it was a one-time deal. I'm like, okay, cool, and show up to TV the next week. Hey, when you get in, go see Road Dogg, Brian James. And Road Dogg's the one that tells me. He's like, hey, we're taking you off of 205. You're permanently on SmackDown now, and you're teaming with AJ Styles tonight, and you guys are working the main event against Andrade and Daniel Bryan. And you're getting the win on Bryan. So obviously, you go from hearing that, you know, you're off for the next 4 weeks to you're working a main event program, SmackDown, and I'm just staring Bryan like dead face. I'm like, who's ribbing me? Like, where's the camera, you know? Yeah, that's how I found out, man. It was all very, like, at the moment. Like, and I don't know if it was a test, or I don't know if it was like, hey, let's just throw him in the water and see what happens. Not just the water, the deep end, you know?
Yeah, and that's kind of the style of WWE. I remember one time when I first had gotten there, I was doing a lot of favors, shall we say, losing a lot.
Yeah.
And I was walking, I showed up somewhere, and I was working with Viscera, and losing, and I snapped, and I was going to walk to Vince's office and demand that, you know, I get a better push, or I'm going to quit. And as I was walking there, I saw one of the writers, and I told him what I was going to do. He says, well, you might not want to go do that, because, you know, after you do the Viscera match, or Viscera was the week before, and he said, today you're going to win the world title from Triple H. And you're kind of like, what? Like, last week I'm losing to Viscera. This week I'm beating Triple H for the title. But that's how the company works.
Yeah, and honestly, someone asked me, they said, when did you know about it? I was like, I didn't. And they go, yeah, because the last time we saw you compete, it was at Survivor Series, and you lost the Cruiserweight Championship match. But then the next time we see you, you're wrestling the WWE Championship. So it's just kind of like, you have no idea where you're at sometimes. And so you get there and you find out what the show is.
Yeah, and like I said, it's the culmination of a lot of hard work, and obviously, you mentioned that Daniel Bryan had wanted to work with you. I mean, maybe he went and vouched for you or something along those lines.
There is I'll never put words in anyone's mouth, but there's so many like inclinations that I'm having that he's got more to say about it than he's letting on.
Right.
I mean, just for a guy to get plucked out of 205. And get put with him in a program, and then, you know, attacking me backstage after my second week on or third week on SmackDown. You know, it's like, it's all very like him. You know what I mean? Like,
sure.
And man, what a guy to learn from. You know, I can't say enough good things about him. But yeah, he'll never like come out and say it to me. I think I have a strong feeling that he's more involved than he's letting on.
You know, it's interesting too, because if you're looking at like size wise, you're just as big as Daniel Bryan is. You know, I mean, that's one thing I always kind of laughed about with 205 Live. It's like, in a lot of ways, what's the difference between the guys on 205 and guys like Daniel Bryan and Seth Rollins? And, you know, the style is all very similar.
Right. And and it's funny that, you know, we're talking about Daniel, too, because he had pointed out in the early stages of 205 that itself was the problem. He said, what is the difference between 205 and when Cedric does a dive versus when Seth Rollins does a dive? He's like, the same style is still being applied on the quote-unquote main roster shows, but what is the real difference? We're presenting these guys at Cruiserweight, so either take off all of the chains and just let them go so they actually stand out, because at the end of the day, if we're not getting the same amount of production or time or presentation, then what is the difference?
Yeah, I mean, when I think back to when you know, WCW, there was the Cruiserweight division. I mean, when you're talking about headliners like, you know, Hall and Nash and Luger and Hogan and the Giant and Savage and Sting and all these really big guys, and then you have your Rey Mysterios and Juventud Guerreros and Eddie Guerreros and Dean Malenkos and those type of things, there is a distinct size and style difference. with 205, right, there really wasn't much of either, because like I said, size-wise, I mean, Seth Rollins and Mustafa Ali and Cedric Alexander and Daniel Bryan, all pretty much in the same category.
Right.
You know?
One of the funny lines I actually like that Daniel Bryan said in our promo, he said he made fun of me for driving an SUV, and he asked why such a small man like myself needs to drive an SUV, but we're standing literally eye to eye, and I'm like, and you know, like, yeah, you talked about size, but I think the biggest issue other than style and size was the initial time slot for 205, because we were going on after SmackDown.
Mm-hmm.
And that's literally like the opening act going on after the headliners.
Right.
You know, I remember standing in Gorilla next to Arya Daivari one time, and we're watching the main event of SmackDown because we're going to go out after it. And it's John Cena versus Randy Orton in a 2 out of 3 falls match. And we're just looking at each other like, we have, right, what are we going to do? You know? And it's after the fact, you know, now that they moved us before SmackDown, and now that's taped, it's a whole different world now, you know, because these fans are ready, they're fresh, they just want to see wrestling now, you know? Mm-hmm. So, you know, yeah, we still have to work to get them, but, you know, if you've been watching the main event of 205 Live, and I fully vouch for, I still fully believe in it, it always delivers. That main event is always killer. It's a good 15 to 20 minute match, and it just, they tear it down.
Let's talk about that a little bit further. So when you first came in to WWE, it was for the what was it called? Was it called the Cruiserweight Classic? Or was it called?
Yeah. Initially, it was the Cruiserweight Classic.
Right.
Yeah, it was a tournament.
So it was a tournament, and you were like a last-minute replacement from what I remember. Is that correct?
Yeah, and man, it was such a, like, you know, WWE like did like a little like mini doc thing for me like a week ago, and I didn't realize how much this story hit with a lot of people, because I got bombarded with messages about like how inspirational the story was. And like when it happens to you, you don't think that it's inspirational. You're like, this sucks. what happened was, you know, like any guy on the indie scene, I've been wrestling for like 16 years. Like everyone thinks I'm like this like new young, like yeah, I'm 32. I've been at it for 16 years. I just couldn't get to that next level. You know, I had like one match with Ring of Honor. Anytime something international came up, like it didn't happen, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So in the Cruiserweight class, this is my last shot, you know? And I had a tryout in 2013 for WWE, and they just said no. They're like, hey, like, we like your work, but you're just aesthetically, you're not what we're looking for. You don't have size. You don't really stand out. There's not really something that we feel that we can plug you into. So, you know, it's a no. So now I'm like, oh, you know, where do I go? What do I
right.
do? When the Cruiserweight Classic comes calling, I talked to Regal, and, you know, he tells me about the tournament and about how it's going to work. And so, all right, he's like, obviously keep this hush-hush until we announce it, of course. So obviously you tell people close to you, like your friends and your family and whatnot. So, you know, I'm waiting for it. And they announce the tournament, and they release the list of all the participants, and my name isn't on the list. And I freak. I'm like, what? Did I do something? Did I not forget to submit something? I thought I signed all the paperwork. You know, and I call. And I find out that, oh, you're not in the tournament. You're just a backup. You're an alternate.
Wow.
If someone gets hurt or can't make it, then you might be in the tournament, but there's also 10 other alternates.
Wow.
So I'm like, yeah. I was like, you know, egg on your face. Like, you know, you've been training. You're trying to get ready. New gear. You just, honestly, it's funny because I vividly remember the day, because it was a terrible day. I was building patio furniture in my backyard. And after I got off the phone with Regal, my wife came out, and she just knew. She's like, what happened? I was like, I feel like an idiot. Like, I really thought I had a shot, and now I don't. So obviously I still go, you know, and I have this chip on my shoulder. I'm like, man, if for whatever reason they crack that door open an inch, I'm going to kick this damn thing down, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And the door cracked open. One of the wrestlers couldn't make it. I don't know, visa issues, or he didn't want to make it or whatever. But I took that opportunity, and they go, you have 5 minutes, first round with Lince Dorado. You're losing, and then see you later. Okay, cool. And Lince Dorado and I go way back. He's a fantastic performer, and we just went out there. We said, we got 5 minutes. We got to make them talk about us in 5 minutes. So now did that. And then I think because they saw how, you know, hungry I was for it and how, you know, detailed I was, because I believe the producer for the match is Sarah Del Rey. She's one of the PC trainers down there.
Mm-hmm.
So I think she can kind of tell, like, I was talking about, like, camera angles and, like, what's the best corner to do this out of or whatever like that. I got invited back to do some NXT work. And, you know, it was, you know, NXT, just like enhancing stuff. And it got to the point where, like, you know, my friends that were in the Cruiserweight Classic are getting signed. Right. And, you know, they're talking about contracts. Nothing for me. Eventually, I see Hunter at a TV taping. And I'm like, I got to shoot my shot, man. He's seen me like five times, you know. So I walk up to him and I go, hey, like, you know, I hope this isn't like too blunt, but you've seen me like five, six times, man. You know when you know. You know, like, what's the deal with me? Do you not? And, you know, he's being nice and he's like, oh, there's so many dogs, there's so many bones, and I can only give up so many bones. Like, you know, be patient, keep working, this and that. And I was like, all right, he's just giving me the polite, like, get lost, kid.
Yeah.
Talk, you know? A week later, I got a call. Hey, we'd like to sign you in a deal, da da da. We're going to do this. We're going to start a cruiserweight division, and we'd like you to be a part of it. So it literally, like, we, you know, we talked about, like, SmackDown, me just showing up. Exact same thing. I just kind of went up and asked for it. You know what I mean? I went from being the backup to, like, getting a deal, you know?
But that's how it goes, though, once again. Had you not gone and said something to him, you know, there's so many guys, like, to Hunter's credit, there are so many, quote-unquote, dogs and so many bones, but for you to go up and talk to him, it takes a lot of guts to do that, but you have to do those sort of things to get noticed.
Yeah, and it wasn't, like, me being a hard ass, like, hey, man, like, I deserve it. It wasn't that at all. It was, like, it was kind of me, like, just let me know if I'm not good enough. You know, like, the tone was, like, can you just let me know? Am I wasting my time here? Like, if there's no way ever that it'll happen, I can take it. Just tell me, you know?
Sure,
and that
sure.
would have been that then, you know? But I don't know if he had known already or what, but I fully believe that conversation helped get me where I'm at today.
Was it, because another thing too is they were going for a real kind of worldwide lineup. And Mustafa Ali, what is your background?
So my dad is from Pakistan.
Okay.
My mom is from India, and I was born here in the States.
Gotcha.
So I have a nice little multicultural background.
Which is what they're looking for too, especially with Pakistan. I think, are you the only Pakistani wrestler that we know of?
Yeah, that's in WWE. I'm the only one of a Pakistani background. First one ever.
So let me ask you this. When you're going to go and pick a name and you choose Mustafa Ali, you know, in this day and age, instantly you're thinking like kind of like some kind of a terrorist type of a gimmick. Mm-hmm. What was that cat's name that was here back in the 2000s with Daivari's brother?
Muhammad Hassan and Sean Daivari.
Yeah, there you go. So like Mustafa Ali. Now, okay. you're picking this name. This is not your actual name. So yep. What's your mindset in choosing that name?
So, you know, everything you said initially, that's exactly what I wanted to avoid when I first started out wrestling. And this is kind of like, it kind of shows you how like screwed up society is. When I started wrestling, I was 16,
mm-hmm.
you know, young. I love wrestling. I want to entertain people, all this stuff. And I go and I get trained. And when it's, you know, when they, you know, decide like, hey, you're ready for a match. And you guys start thinking about a character. I was thinking like, you know, this guy. And they go, no. You're a Muslim. You got to be a bad guy. What do you mean I have to be bad? I'm like, no, we're going to call you Sheikh Abdullah something, something. And you're going to come out with a, you know, a vest that looks like you have a bomb on. You're going to threaten this. And you're going to drag the American flag. And I was not terrified in the sense of like, you know, someone's going to hurt me. Terrified in the sense of like, that's this, like, no, I don't want to do that.
Right.
And I was in high school when 9/11 happened.
Mm.
So I didn't get bullied. Like, I didn't get, like, treated differently. But I definitely felt people looked at me differently. And it was a time, you know, when 9/11 happened, obviously it affected everybody. It affected me, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I'm an American, you know? Like, and I'm like, oh, my God, people died. Like, this is terrible. This is evil. So we would have these classroom discussions, and people were encouraged to talk freely. And I always remember, like, kids, my friends were like, we got to go overseas and we got to kill all of them. Kill all the Muslims. And I'm like, and I'm sitting right next to them. And I'm like, holy, like, and I didn't get mad at them because I could understand their mindset. I was like, they're tuning into the TV and all they're seeing is anyone that has a Muslim-like name that looks like a Muslim presented as evil. So they're going to associate that with bad, evil. I was like, man, I don't want to push that agenda and be a part of that. So I refused to do that type of character initially. I was like, hey, I love high flying. I love lucha libre. Can I just put on a mask and pass myself off as a luchador? So everyone's like, I mean, you're going to do what you want to do. So that's what I did for the first, you know, 4 or 5 years. I put on a mask. I try to pretend to be like, you know, this luchador. And obviously, like, the wrestling was fine, but there was no connection to the crowd. I was just a guy doing moves. You know, there was no real personality behind me. There's no connection. I actually ended up getting hurt. I broke my wrist, and I was out for a few months because I had to wear, like, a full-arm cast. It was silly. But I was just so frustrated with wrestling at that point because, like, you know, I'm not really breaking out of the local bubble. Everyone keeps telling me I don't have character. I need to work on this. And eventually I got talked into. The decision was myself. And, you know, it was a low point for me because I kind of, like, caved into the pressure. And I was like, all right, fine, I'll do the evil foreigner character and I'll just try it. Wow, so, yeah. You know, they're, we want you to be a prince from Saudi Arabia. Come up with a name, you know. I was like, all right, Prince. Well, you know, Prince Ali, you know, people know that from Aladdin. Okay, Ali. Well, I'm a big fan of Muhammad Ali, Prince. No, I can't be Muhammad Ali. Mustafa, you know, I'm looking up royal. Oh, Mustafa. Mustafa's a royal name. Okay, Prince Mustafa. Okay, fine. So Prince Mustafa Ali came up to that. And is this like, it's an easier name for people to remember, too. Like Prince Ali. If you can't remember Mustafa, at least you remember Prince Ali. And man, it was a hit for this, like, because I'm from the Chicago indie scene, you know?
Right.
So instantly I come back and it's like, I'm getting bookings, I'm getting flown out, I'm cutting these terrible promos and all anti-America this, anti-America that. And it was so easy. So easy. Like, it came to the point where, like, I was like, man, this is a joke. I can literally go out there and just speak a different language and make it up. And not even make sense, and they're gonna boo me out the building, and that's what happened every night, dude. Like, I had such a strong character that, like, the work was obviously, like, became like a second concern of mine. Like, it was just about the promo and, like, what I was gonna wear and how I could piss people off.
And I hated,
I hated every second of it.
Did you feel like you were selling out?
Yeah, absolutely. I felt like, it sounds really weird to say, but I kind of like fell out of love with wrestling for a while I was doing it. I was like, man, let me go do this. You know, like, obviously I had love for it cause I'm still doing it. And it's not like I'm making a living off of it. You know, I still have a full-time job. I was still going to school and stuff like that, but this is obviously a dream of mine. I'm still chasing it. But like, I hated doing that character. I hated it. And the turning point for me was, I was in Oak Forest, Illinois. And I remember, at some point in the match had spilled outside, and there's a young kid. He must have been like 6, 7, 8, something like that. And as I'm walking near the guardrail, he jumps out of his chair and he puts both of his fists up like he wants to fight, but not in like a, like he was playing, like out of like fear or anger. And I remember looking dead into his eyes. He's this blonde hair, blue eye kid. And I was like, holy crap. I just taught this kid to hate me and to hate people that look like me. And it wasn't like, oh no, brother, you're getting good heat. No, this kid was like, you Muslim scum piece of, you know, like I saw it in his face and I was like, what am I doing, man? Mm-hmm. Like, I know this is a small indie show. I know no one's going to see this, but like that kid, he's going to go to high school with another kid that looks like me. You know what I mean? Like, and I was that kid in high school that had to sit there while everyone stood up and says, we should go overseas and kill them all. Like, I'm pushing that agenda on this young mind. And yeah, like, you know, that might be a stretch, but like, I felt it, you know? And I was like, I'm not doing this crap anymore, man. I'm done with it. And that was the last time I did it. I was like, hey, I'm just going to go by Mustafa Ali. I'm not saying anything negative about America because I don't have any, you know, I'm from America.
You're like, American, yeah.
I'm going to make the crowd the heel. And they go, how are you going to do that? I was like, by not being a heel, I was like, I'm just going to come out and they're going to boo me. And I'm going to point that out to them. I said, you guys are literally booing me because of my name and how I look. You're the heel, not me, you know? So I ran with that for a while. But yeah, it was always like, is this interesting, like how wrestling kind of reflects society? You know what I mean? Like, sure. It was like, I lived in that time frame where, like, you know, like Muslims or Arabs or Middle Eastern, like they were the bad guy, like no matter what.
But the thing is there's a huge difference between people from Pakistan and Al Qaeda.
Oh yeah. I would say there's a few differences. Yeah.
But I guess just because of the way you look, like you said, and in that time frame, I want to talk a little bit more about that. So when 9/11 happens, How did, like, once again, you're getting lumped in with, you know, with anybody that has, you know, dark skin and black hair and, you know, looks that certain way. Did you feel some prejudice against you? I know you mentioned it in school, but just the whole state of the country at that point in time, how did that make you and your family feel?
I felt like I had to explain myself a lot. You know what I mean? Like, I was 16, man. Like, I just want to go out and, like, date a girl and go to the movies. You know what I mean? Like, sure. I'm a normal 16-year-old kid from Chicago. Like, but I found myself having to defend myself. Like, oh, no. My family's not like that. Oh, no. That's not how it really is. You know? And I don't know why I took it upon myself to speak, because I could have just been quiet. Like, and again, no one was, like, targeting me. No one was, like, picking on. Like, I didn't get beat up in high school for being a Muslim. It wasn't that. But I always felt like an outsider in that sense. But like, it was passed off as like, we are Americans. I'm an American too. Like, I
just like, as much. What do you mean?
And like, you know, a part of me is like, as much as it sucked, I was kind of happy that people spoke so openly in front of me. And even if it was offensive, I'm glad they did, because it made me realize like, yo, like, perception and influence is a real thing, even at this age. Like, we are so easily influenced as a society and as human beings. Like, if I constantly tell you, Chris, like, that something's bad, and I keep showing you something's bad, but it's all one-sided, like, you're gonna have, like, yeah, you know, you're a well-traveled man, you're intelligent, you'll be able to form your own opinion, but you're gonna have my voice in your head. You go, well, you know, Ali told me about this guy being bad, so I'm gonna be a little cautious, you know. So, like, yeah, it just, like, and again, it wasn't like, you know, my house didn't get egged and, like, burglarized, but, like, people around me did. You know, like, the mosque that I went to got vandalized. You know, I've heard about kids getting beat up. Like, so all this stuff is happening. It didn't happen directly to me, but I'm very self-conscious and aware of it. So, you know, that's carried over till today. Like, I'm very specific about how I present myself to people.
It seems like it's something that Vince and WWE would really take – find very unique and take pride in, or like having Mustafa Ali come out as a babyface. It's the exact opposite what you would expect within the cliched world of wrestling, but in the real world, it's the perfect time for this.
Yeah, and again, it's actually Road Dogg that pitched the idea, because when 205 had started, they did want me to be the bad guy, so they had the big Pakistani flag on my entrance, and like, you know, obviously you put up any flag that's not the American flag, you'll get heat, you know. And they weren't gonna push it like, oh, he's a quote unquote, you know, evil foreigner, but they were pushing the anti-American agenda,
right?
But very, like, you know, subtly. And you know, I was kind of like, oh, I don't want to do this. So they said, oh, go ahead and do your, like, introduction promo package, you can say whatever you want. So I was like, okay, I'm gonna use that trick I did from the indies where I make the crowd the bad guy, not me. So my first line in WWE ever is, my name is Mustafa Ali, and you've already made up your mind about me.
I remember that.
Yeah, and everyone, like, I see the camera guy look at each other, and, like, and you know, the producer goes, like, oh, like, where are you going with this? I was like, this is who I am, man. I was like, I'm not wearing some sheet over my head. I'm not speaking in a foreign language. My name is Mustafa Ali, and you've already made up your mind about me. What does it say about you? So obviously, you know, like, Road Dogg, LMC, and then the next, so I had one match as a bad guy, and then immediately they turned me into a good guy because they saw this promo. So Road Dogg pulls me aside, and he's like, man, like, you're right. Like, why do we have to make you the bad guy? Why don't, you know, you have this great move set. He's like, you know, I think we can, like, mold it and, you know, make it fit the WWE style, but, like, yeah, we're going to run with you as a baby, and let's see what happens. Mm-hmm. So I was all for it, you know, like, I was like, yeah, dude, like, I fully believe I can do it, you know, and, here we are 2 years later, huh?
No kidding. Tell me a little bit more, like, when you guys first came in with 205 Live, because it was the same thing when there's a lot of examples when all the WCW guys came in at once, when all of the women, there's the Women's Revolution, there was a whole bunch of new women that came in, and then 205 Live guys. It's hard when, if just one person comes out, you can build the character, you can get to know them. But when there's 10, 15, 20 guys coming out all at once in this weird time slot, how was it for you guys, you know, from the start all the way until you basically got moved in your time slot?
Yeah, I always wonder like how upset like the old timers are that the locker room keeps getting like more and more crowded. You know what I mean? Like all these, there's 15 cruiserweights in here at one time. Who are these guys? You know, and, like right. We're all huddled up in a corner, like bags on top of bags, so that we can give the guys their space and stuff like that. But yeah, like we talked about, like I felt like the biggest problem was the time slot when 205 was shot. The second biggest problem was we're not only building like brand new superstars. We're doing a bunch of them at once, and we're trying to build a brand. Mm-hmm. So it's one thing, you know, if you want to make Cedric Alexander in one night, what do? You have him come out and have him answer Seth Rollins, open challenge. And they have a crazy match for 20 minutes, and people are invested because they care about Seth. And now Cedric shows he can hang with Seth, and now Cedric is made. But now Cedric has to go out with me, who they don't know, and they barely know him, and now we're going out after SmackDown, you know what I mean? So it was like, there's difficulty in building a superstar, but then imagine trying to build multiple superstars and a brand mm-hmm. at the same time. To me, it's not a fair comparison at all. 205, you know, always gets compared to NXT. They go, you know, what's the difference between NXT and 205? NXT like is doing great with, NXT has a platform and an established brand that took almost a decade to establish. Like, NXT isn't new. It's been around for a very long time. Like, Daniel Bryan was in NXT at one point. You know what I mean? Like, when it was when they do the tryout stuff and the competitions and stuff like that. Like, David Otunga was on and stuff like that. So it's not like this brand new hot brand that just popped up. Like, NXT has been around for quite a while. And then they brought in all these international stars to help build this brand. 205 got none of that. You know what I mean? Like, it's all like these, you know, guys from the independent scenes. The most well-known guy on our roster is Brian Kendrick. And like, obviously we know how great he is, but like, he'll be the first one to tell you, like, he's not Seth Rollins level as far as popularity.
Right.
So like that was our big thing. We're like, man, like we're trying to build each other and a brand at the same time. And this is hard. Like, we have to get them to care. So, you know, kudos to those guys. Like, they're still doing it. Like, I'm still helping out when I can. But, like, we had to take it upon ourselves to, like, do our own promos and our own backstage things and kind of find our own voice. And, like, how can we leverage this platform? Even though, obviously, it's still a huge opportunity, but we're not getting the full scope of everything that WWE can give us. So, like, we've got to turn heads one way or another.
And there have been a few guys that kind of have stood out a little bit. I think back, when Rich Swann was there with his entrance, I'm thinking about Drew Gulak with his whole kind of political thing.
Yeah.
So there have been some guys that have stood out. Were the guys happy for you when you told them, or when did they watch your match? Were you getting feedback from the boys when you came back?
Yeah. Man, it's like, I mean, you know, we talked about how hard it is performing on 205, and I believe that difficulty and that, like, that just that grind and, you know, the frustration that comes with it, it made us all get, like, really close really quickly, you know, because, like, we're like, okay, we have to stick together to make this work. Like, you know, when everyone first got there, it was all everyone's, you know, competing and, you know, all for themselves. Like, we learned very quickly, like, we got to watch each other's backs. We got to protect each other. Like, this is the only way it's going to work. When the match with Brian happened, the first thing that happened was I came backstage and they were all standing there and they had watched the entire match and it was like, oh, congrats. And like, I was like, man, like I'm getting like feedback from Vince. I'm getting feedback from Brian, like AJ, like, you know, I've looked up to guys like Jeff Hardy and like Rey Mysterio my entire life, you know, and like, they're giving me props and like, oh man, you belong here. And so, but like all of that meant the world, but like to come back and see, like, you know, your brothers in arms, like the guys right. that, you know, you were in the trenches with, they're standing there and they're all genuinely happy for you. Like, dude, that was heavy. It was a very heavy moment for me. I was like, this meant the most. And then Jack Gallagher showed me a photo after the fact of them. They're literally, the WWE ended up taking a photo, or Jack took a photo, I'm not sure. But they took a photo of all of them like huddled around the monitor backstage by Gorilla, watching
great.
The entire match. And I was like, man, like that's like, you know, that's when you kind of know, like, there's something special there. Like, all these guys are, like, rooting for you. So, yeah, man, that meant the most. Like, out of everything, as wild as that night was, like, that meant the most.
Having the respect of your peers means, you know, there's one thing having the fans respect you, but the peers respecting you is almost, if not more important.
Yeah, definitely. Like, what greater adulation, you know, can you get that someone that gets it, you know, someone that knows how difficult this is, they appreciate you or what you're able to do. And yeah, man, like, that's the highest compliment you can get.
What was Vince's advice and feedback to you?
You know, and the thing that blew me away was this is just small things, you know, like, Vince has always been very, like, you know, positive feedback. I've actually went and met with him a few times to kind of, like, introduce myself and, like, what I represent, like, this conversation we're having right now. Like, hey, like, I just want you to let you know, this is my background. This is what I think is cool. This is how I think the company can leverage me. So, you know, he's I've talked to him before, but this was the first time he gave me very specific direction on how he thought I could make money in WWE. And, I, you know, I came back and, you know, he gave me feedback about the promo and this and that. And he goes, the one thing I wish you would have changed. And he's like, you got to remember, a guy like you, you're always, always fighting from under. He goes, you have this rare quality to get actual empathy from the crowd. He goes, that's so hard nowadays. Nowadays, people are just like, oh, whatever. He goes, I feel like you have the ability to actually make people go, man, he's really taking a beating. He goes, that's where you're going to make your money. He goes, you're always, always fighting. And he's like, kind of like pointing at my chest when he's saying that. He goes, that's how you're going to make your money. And I was like, holy crap. Like, and it's crystal clear direction now. You know what I mean? Like, this is what he sees me as. I'm like, okay, yeah, I can do that, boss. And he's like, all right, good job. And, you know, that was it. You know, it was very, very quick, obviously. But I was like, man, like, that was the most, like, clear, like, this is what I want from you that I've gotten from you. Okay, then that's what you're going to get, you know?
Well, but like you said, that's direct orders, not just a random, like, well, just work hard and grab the brass ring and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, you guys really worked hard. Thank you. You know, like,
yeah.
And we've gotten that before. We came back and goes, oh, guys, thanks for working really hard. I appreciate that. Thanks. And, you know, he's right back to the monitor. I was like, oh, okay. But this was like, stand up in my, look me in the eye. This is what I want. This is what I see you as. And I was like, okay, I've got, like you said, like a direct order. Like, all right.
That's very valuable. You know, that's currency right there.
Yep.
Okay, so before we talk about Mustafa's finish, the amazing move that he does, the, what is it, 504, whatever the hell he calls it, and his former gig as a Chicago police officer, I think I found something to help get your 2019 off to a good start financially. That's my new sponsor, Robinhood. Now look, if you're like me, the stock market and investing might as well be a foreign language. I don't have time for that. My mind drifts away. Don't know what anybody's talking about. I don't know anything about buying or selling stocks, but with Robinhood, I didn't have to, because Robinhood is an awesome app that lets you buy and sell stocks, ETFs, and cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin, all commission-free. Free trades. This is the perfect app if you're new to the stock market and aren't really sure exactly what to do or how trading works. Robinhood walks you through the whole process and gives you lots of information to help you make some good decisions about what to buy and what to sell. They send custom notification on price movements for stocks so you don't miss out on the right moment to invest. They have a personalized news feed so you can discover and track new stocks and companies. They have stock collections like 100 most popular and entertainment stocks and social media so you can compare. And then in like four taps and one swipe on your smartphone, you can buy or sell stocks. It really is that easy. If you sign up at jericho.robinhood.com, you'll get a free stock like Apple, Ford, or Sprint to help build your portfolio. That's right, a free stock from Apple, Ford, Sprint, something like that. It's going to help build your portfolio. All you got to do is sign up at jericho.robinhood.com and get your free stock. That's jericho.robinhood.com. Invest in yourself and your family. Believe in your instincts. Learn about the stock market and trade for free. So let Robinhood get you started, give you a free stock in the process, become a financial wizard, an investment guru. Sign up now at jericho.robinhood.com. That's jericho.robinhood.com. Go do it now. Make yourself some money. Let's talk about your finish. I remember when you first came in, that was the move where I was like, you know, so many guys doing all these great things. And that was the one that... I remember when I first saw Rey Mysterio when I was in Japan. You'd see the Japanese magazines, and it would show you photo by photo of what he was doing. And sometimes I couldn't comprehend, like, what the hell? Like, what is he doing? And that's the same thing with your finish. When you first did it, I was like, how is that even possible? What is that? Where did you come up with that idea? Is that a diving move, or what the hell is it?
Man, I'm not even sure like what the initial idea was. I was just doing the 450 splash initially. You know, I'd go to the top rope and do it for, and you know, like there's different variations of it, obviously.
Right.
But
a front flip into a splash. Yeah.
Yeah, and I remember initially thinking like, man, like, you know, obviously, like I said, growing up, I was a huge Jeff Hardy fan. And I remember initially thinking, I was like, I wonder if it's possible to do Jeff Hardy's Swanton Bomb, but going backwards. Like, I would jump backwards and do a Swanton Bomb.
Hold on, I'm trying to visualize. If you start
almost looking like you're going to do like a moonsault. Yeah. But you jump back and then in. So, again, I was like 16, 17, and you think you're indestructible.
Of course.
And, you know, I put out this crash pad, you know, like I'm messing with it. And for whatever reason, I just jumped too hard one time. And as I went to kind of like do the swanton, like the roll, I just ended up like doing a full rotation. I was like, what? And I landed on my stomach and my face. And everyone's like, you just did a backwards 450. I was like, what? Like, you just did a backwards 450. I was like, oh, obviously 16 at the time. I was like, oh, that was easy. So I climb up and I do it again. And then I do it again. I was like, dude, that's a finish. That's a backwards 450, you know? And I was like, oh my God, I'm going to change the business with this move. You know, no one's ever done it before. You know, eventually you get on YouTube and you find out like, you know, someone in Japan's already done it, or, you know, someone in Mexico's already done it. You're like, all right, whatever. But yeah, like that's how I stuck with it. So I was doing it for a while. When I came up to WWE, I hadn't been using the move as much. And, you know, obviously because I was a heel. So I was like, all right, I'm going to do this move. And when they made that switch right away, they go, all right, you're going to be a baby. I was like, I haven't worked babyface in like 5 years. I'm like, what am I doing? I'm trying to come with a move. And Adam Pierce, he's like, didn't you used to do that thing, that backwards thing? And I was like, oh no, he remembers. And I was like, yeah. I was like, I haven't done it in a while. He's like, well, we can get a crash pad out here. You can try it right now. I was like, and everyone like is looking, you know, like Road Dog's looking, Hunter's looking, Michael Hayes is looking. I was like, oh man, I was like, I haven't done this move in 5 years. I was like, yeah, no problem. And so they bring out the crash pad. I was like, oh man, you better not botch this, you know?
Right.
So I was like, go ahead. And they go, yeah, that's your finisher now. Like, okay, cool. So yeah, and eventually, like now we dub it the 054, 450 backwards, obviously. And yeah, nice. It's cool, man. Like, I feel like it's a move that, you know, because I started working the SmackDown live events, and like, a lot of the guys are giving me like a lot of feedback, and they're saying people are still trying to process what you just did.
Right.
You know what I mean? They're like, man, like you stand up there and like, oh, this is cool. And then I do the move, and then there's this impact, and there's like this delayed reaction before they like erupt. And they go, people are literally like, what did he do? Wow. And then there's, you know, it's not, you know, when Jeff does a swanton, they hear it and they pop right away. You know, there's always this like awkward 1 or 2 second, you know, delay and reaction, and I couldn't figure out what it was. And they're like, we just think of this people just processing what you're doing. And I was like, oh, okay. Well, it's normal to me now. You know, it's not a big deal to me.
But someone sees it
for the first time, like, what did that guy just do?
It doesn't make sense. Like I said, like visually, okay, you talk about a swanton, the guy jumps forward, lands on his back. You talk about a moonsault, the guy jumps backwards, lands on his stomach. I get that.
Yeah.
With yours, like I said, it's one of those ones, like those old Rey Mysterio moves where I just can't comprehend what the hell just happened. Yeah. So I can totally get that. I can see that.
Yeah, man. Just jump and tuck.
It's one of those ones, if I was taking that from you, like when I used to work with Too Cold Scorpio, because Scorpio would do like a front flip into a leg drop or, you know, shooting star press. And Scorpio was about 250 pounds, like super agile. But I would just close my eyes and hope for the best. Like, he's going to hit me either way, and I don't really know how I can adjust with all these.
Yeah, just put me where you need me, man. Just put me where you need me.
Exactly. But that's what happened when you had the match with Daniel Bryan. You kind of did hit him with your knees.
Yeah. And, dude, that was a freak out. So that was the tag match. And there's no explanation behind it other than, like, it just, you know, like, no one bats 100, man. Like, yeah. It wasn't out of position. It wasn't like we were rushing on time, you know, because SmackDown has to be off. It was none of that. And I was, you know, obviously when it happened, like, you could, you know, anyone that could see that I was like, holy, I just landed on, you know, his face. Luckily, when we came back, you know, we found out it was his chin. Like, I mean, still, you know, you could knock someone out easily with that way. But it's almost like as it happened, like, you just see me kind of like, I'm trying to, like, make myself even lighter, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
like,
of course.
So that I don't squish him.
Yeah.
But, you know, yeah, I got him, and dude, I felt, you know, one, you're thinking, like, oh, did I just, you know, mess up the WWE champion? And, like, you know, heat, what's going to happen? This is my first night.
There goes my push.
Yeah, there goes my push, you know, like, whatever. And you're freaking out. And it was extra stressful because it was a night that we were taping the second SmackDown for Christmas. So I had a match right after that.
Wow.
I'm trying to get mentally ready for that. And that the finish was that move again, you know? So now you're talking about, like, you know, playing games with your mind. You're like, oh, am I going to, you know, land on CN on this one too? And, you know, luckily I got some good brothers back there that are like, you know, giving me a pep talk, like, yo, get your head in the game. He's fine. This and that. And, you know, literally they checked him. Brian was fine. He came, assured me he was fine. Obviously, I'm profusely apologizing that it happened. And, you know, everyone talked to him. They go, you realize people, like, get knocked out throwing kicks. People get knocked out throwing punches. You're doing a backwards 450, and you clipped a dude. And you didn't even hurt him. You just clipped him. You know, it looked nasty, but you clipped him. Like, relax. But obviously, to me, it was the end of the world, you know? Like, oh, my God, like, you know, this and that. Thankfully, you know, he wasn't injured. Thankfully that, you know, nothing came of it as far as, like, you know, backlash from me. But, like, you know, obviously, like, some people are going to nitpick it. Like, oh, he's unsafe. I was like, I've been wrestling 16 years and I landed, you know, I kneed a guy in the face accidentally. It wasn't, like, sloppy. It just happened. And I can't explain why. I thought the jump was good. I thought the rotation was good. I thought his positioning was good. It was just off, you know?
It's a high-risk maneuver. I mean, that's not a cliche.
Hey, look at that.
You know, I mean, that's really what it is. And that, like you said, that happens with so many things that we do.
I was talking to Jack about it one time. He's like, you know, like, wrestling is really unique in the sense that, like, you watch a professional boxer, they don't land every punch. Mm-hmm. You know, you watch baseball players, they don't hit every ball, you know, like, why are we expected that every time we do something, it's got to be perfect and precise? It's like, it's kind of like the nature of the beast, I guess. But, like, yeah, man, it was a freak accident.
Well, yeah.
And luckily it wasn't more than anything that, you know, I just clipped him and rocked him for a second. But, like, you know, luckily that's all it was. But yeah, you know, you got to own up to it. And I did. And I apologize profusely for it, you know?
Well, like you said, I mean, we're all in this together, and there's accidents and there's stiff shots, and the accidents are cool. The stiff shots are the ones where you're like, what the hell? But let's talk a little bit, speaking of shots, in a segue, before you got into wrestling, your job was pretty impressive even before that.
What a great segue, though. That was very well done. Yeah. For those of you that don't know, I was actually one of the boys in blue. I was a police officer.
A Chicago cop.
4 years. Yeah. Yeah. Talk about dodging some shots there. And, you know, like, before the internet goes wild, oh, Mustafa used to be a cop. I hate cops. I get it. There's a lot of people, and there's a lot of distrust with law enforcement. And that in itself is one of the primary reasons that I became a cop. Mm. Not to, like, get on my soapbox here, but I'm a firm believer in, like, if you really believe that something needs to change, you got to change it from
right. Within. That's a good point.
You have to. And I was like, man, not that I got, like, in trouble with the law, but I've had bad experiences with cops too, just being like, man, that guy was an a-hole for, like, no reason, like, total abuse of power, talking down to us, like, you know, just being a bully. And I, you know, and then, you know, you watch, obviously you watch the news and you see all these terrible things happening, young people, you know, getting shot and killed over nothing. And you know, these body cam investigations about police abusing power and planting evidence. I was like, this is terrible. And I've always had a sense in like, you know, how you kind of just, you're attracted towards certain things. I was like, man, like, I love the idea of, like, serving the people, or, like, justice, or, like, whatever. My name, my real name is Adil Alam, and it literally translates to one who serves justice.
Hmm.
So, and I didn't grow up like, oh, I want to be a cop when I grow up. I always wanted to be, you know, a wrestler when I wanted to grow up. But I was always like, man, that's a cool job. Like being a cop, like saving someone's life and being this, like that's cool. You know, that's admirable. It's respectable. So I've always had that like attraction to it, I guess. And, you know, one thing leads to another, and I'm working, you know, a marketing job. I, you know, went to school for marketing, you know, and doing the indie thing, and not really thinking WWE or any, you know, thing big in wrestling is going to happen. So, you know, am I really happy with what I'm doing? You know, my buddy, who also used to wrestle, he becomes a cop, and he's telling me all these stories about, like, how he's helping people and how it's good pay and the insurance and a pension and, you know, this and that, and then obviously like the cool stuff too that comes with it. And I was like, you know, I'm just gonna give it a shot. And you know, after testing for a little while, I eventually landed a spot. And I went in with the sole intention. I was like, man, I want to prove that like good people can be cops. Like I want to actually be there for the people. And you know, it was obviously a learning experience, because I went into it as a civilian, seeing how bad the police are, but now I have the unique perspective of seeing both sides.
Right.
You know what I mean? I have firsthand experience about how dangerous and how unpredictable this job is, and why some cops might be a little bit on the edge when dealing with people they don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was only a cop for 4 years, and I can count at least 3 or 4 times where I knew someone was actively going to try to kill me. You know,
wow.
And that's like, you think about this stuff and it's like, man, this is, imagine the cop that's been on the job for 20 years. How many times do you think he's been, you know, he's thought someone's tried to kill him?
Well, that's the thing. Every single person you approach, you have to approach them as a threat.
Yeah. And it's a unique situation, because I do feel like there's a problem in law enforcement and how they treat citizens. So I believe, and this is just from my experience, you know, and from my town, I believe the officer should take the extra step to try to defuse a situation before there is one.
Right.
So obviously, if I'm pulling over someone that's wanted for murder, there's nothing I can do. That's going to be a situation. What happens often is no one wants to get pulled over. No one wants to deal with the police, especially when they feel like they're being profiled. So if I'm pulling someone over, and they feel this cop is only pulling me over because of my skin color, there's already a problem. So I took the extra step that when I would, you know, interact with people, I would always try to defuse the situation by immediately throwing out that mindset that they have. So I would knock on the window and they would lower the window, and they're expecting me to say, sir, I'm so-and-so with this department. I need to see your license and insurance, or, hey, you were speeding, or do you have any idea how fast you're going? This is what they're expecting.
Right.
The first question I ask is, excuse me, sir, is everything okay?
Hmm.
And they, what do you mean is everything okay? Man, I saw you flying like a bat out of hell down the highway there. Is everything okay? I just want to make sure you're good. I don't know if you have an emergency or anything like that. And the guy's like, no, everything's fine, officer. I'm like, oof. Good, man. I just want to make sure you're cool. Hey, man, you mind if I just grab your license and insurance real quick? I just, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I've already defused the situation because the guy's like, oh, this guy was just checking on me.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, it's just a little trick. But then obviously there's situations where, like, you approach the car and it's already, the guy's getting on the car, you know? So it's, you try to, you know, I always went in the mentality of, let me always try to, and that's the reputation I end up getting as a cop. They're like, if he shows up, he's going to talk, like, not talk people off the ledge, like, literally, but, like, I always show up to, like, all right, this is about to be a fight. All right, let's all calm down. Let's talk about it. You just try to relate with people, man. Like, people make mistakes. People are out there hurting for money, you know, or people have drug and alcohol problems. Like, you got to come down to the level and show them that you care. And, you know, how many times, you know, like, I've literally got into, like, you know, we're taking a guy in custody, and this guy's just throwing fists. He's landing a few. We're actively fighting. And, you know, by the time we get cuffs on him, I'm still calling him sir. Mm-hmm. I'm asking him if he needs medical attention. We process him. We book him. And, you know, right before he's getting transferred, he's like, hey, man, I owe you an apology. He's like, you treated me with nothing but respect this entire time. He goes, I just want to say I'm sorry and you know, and apologize to me. So it's like people will notice that. So if police officers and cops have that mindset of like, hey, we're going to try to defuse situations. We're going to try to show people that we actually care. I think it will resonate, you know, but obviously that can't be every single time because, you know, like I said, I was a cop for 4 years and I can count at least 3 or 4 times when someone's like, as soon as they saw me, okay, this guy's trying to kill me.
like actually taking shots at you, or how were they trying to kill you?
Yeah, so like the wild one was I pulled over a vehicle, and you know when you pull over a car and you're running the license plate, the vehicle owner information, you know, comes up, and dispatch gives you the information, you know, how tall this person is, what their name is, if they have any warrants, you know, their license status and whatnot. So I'm pulling over a car that's driving in the middle of the night with no headlights on, or I had one headlight, something like that, you know. And as I'm walking up to the vehicle, dispatch is telling me, they go, hey, the registered owner for this vehicle has a warrant for traffic, and he has a suspended driver's license. Not a big deal. It's, you know, hey man, you're not supposed to be driving. So as I'm walking up to the car on the driver's side, I just get that spidey sense, man. Something's not right. You know, the hair on the back of my neck stands up. And as I'm approaching the vehicle, I have my flashlight. And, you know, one of the tricks that cops do, they put the flashlight right in the rear mirror or the side mirror so that the driver can't see you approaching. So I flash my flashlight into this guy's side mirror, and his eyes do not budge. He is staring directly into this mirror, directly at me, and he's not blinking, he's not moving, and just the creepiest sense came up to me. I was like, his eyes are speaking very bad intentions, and I don't know how or why. He's not doing anything. His hands are on the steering wheel. He's not shouting. He's not moving. I was like, something ain't right, you know? Mm-hmm. So I get on the radio. I said, hey, go ahead and send me a second police officer. You know, and, you know, it was a smaller town, so another officer shows up, you know, rather quickly. You know, and I'm staring at this driver. A second unit shows up. So the second cop is approaching from the passenger side, and he's looking at me like, hey, like, what do you got? What's up? What's wrong? And I'm just shaking my head like some, like, without saying something, he knows that I'm trying to say something ain't right, you know? So the second cop starts approaching from the passenger side as I approach from the driver's side. Right when, you know, the guy starts cracking his window with his left hand, and then his left hand goes down to his side. I stop on the driver's side right behind his window. So I didn't poke my head through the window. And right when I stop, my partner steps up to the passenger side, and he flashes his light through the window. This guy was holding a butcher knife.
Oh, my gosh.
A huge butcher knife. I'd say at least 12 inches of blade. In his left hand, and he had it positioned right under the window. So had I poked my head in, you know, to talk to him, or he got close to it, all he had to do was raise his hand, and who knows what would have happened to me. So obviously my partner yells out, you know, that he's got a knife, you know? So obviously we have to draw our guns at this point and take this guy into custody. We, you know, we get this guy into custody. I was like, man, this guy tried to like stab me in the face over a suspended driver's license and a warrant. No, that's not the case. That's not his car. That's his brother's car that he was driving. This guy was wanted for, he beat his wife, from another state, he beat his wife so bad that she was in a medically induced coma, and he was fleeing. So he was wanted for, like, aggravated felony battery.
Oh, my gosh.
So he was going to jail, you know what I mean? Like, so he was, right. You know, so to him, this was worth it. And, you know, that's just, like, one instance of, like, you know, how do I defuse that situation? What could I have possibly done other than, like, you know, this guy's got a knife and he's ready to take a shot at me, obviously. So, yeah, and that was like my, like, you know, like within my first year on the job. So obviously, you know, like I'm working this midnight shift, and like, that was the beginning of the shift. And I'm like sitting there, I was like, is this how it's going to be every night? You know? But, yeah, man, that was a scary one.
Did the, police department know that you were wrestling still as well on the weekends or whatever?
Oh man. Yeah. And when they found out, they weren't too happy. So, obviously, you know, wrestling and the police were kind of identical in the sense of, like, you know, the young rookie comes in and all the vets give him a hard time, and they kind of rib him and test him out, and, you know, you got to earn your keep, you know, you clean up the place afterwards. Yeah, it's the same deal over here. Yeah. So, you know, when I came in, I was the rookie. So, you know, boys want to go out afterwards, I would buy them drinks, or, like, you know, I clean up the locker room, all this stuff. So I would show up to a roll call, you know, before you start your shift, you all sit around the table, roll call, the sergeant tells you what needs to get done, and, you know, who's doing a bad job, who's doing a good job, and you go about your deal. So I would show up to roll call, and I would always show up, like, if I had to be there at 11, I would show up at, like, 10:59 with, like, 17 seconds left, and I'd come running in and sit down. And my sergeant looks at me, and, you know, you're supposed to be presentable and clean, and, you know, I'm wearing, and he's like, why are you sweating? I was like, oh, sorry. He's like, why do you always show up with, like, new scratches on your faces, on your face? And, like, why do you have, like, why are your knuckles all bruised up? And I was like, ah. So I told those guys that I'm learning how to box. And they're like, man, you must be like a really bad boxer because like every week you're showing up with like a new, you know, you got a little gimmick here, a little thing, you know. And the thing was, I was doing indie shows, you know, and I would try to be like the first or second match. I'd do the match, jump in my car, drive the 45 minutes to the police department, put my stuff on and run up to roll call. Because, you know, indie shows start around like 8 o'clock, 7:30, something like that. So I had to make it, you know, in that time span. So, you know, sometimes I didn't even get to shower, man. I literally had to throw my stuff on and go to work. Eventually, what happened is the Cruiserweight Classic happened.
Right.
And a dispatcher was watching it. And they go, wait a minute. I know that guy. So she takes a picture from her TV and sends it to my sergeant. So the next day at roll call, I show up. He's like, do you care to explain this? And I was like, oh, no. Oh. Secret's out. So, I mean, they weren't too thrilled about it because the issue was, like, if I got hurt doing that, it affects my job, obviously, you know? Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a bunch of red tape about it. And eventually they asked me, like, hey, like, you know, are you, you know, is it secondary employment? Like, it became a whole deal. But eventually, you know, they couldn't tell me not to do it because it was outside of that. But I understand their concern about, like, hey, you know, if you get hurt doing that, like, it's going to affect your job, obviously. So
were you,
that's all they wanted to know.
Were you a police officer until you basically got signed by the WWE?
Yeah. And unfortunately, the way I left, it was the only job that I quit, you know, without giving notice. And the reason wasn't because, like, oh, I'm quitting. I'm going to WWE. See you later, suckers. The reason I quit is because this mentality that I had about being a good police officer and, you know, treating people with respect. My, you know, a lot of the police officers gave me props for it, but, like, the higher ups that are, like, old school, kind of like, you know, stuck in their ways, I guess is a nice way to say it, weren't so receptive to
right.
it. Like one example is I saw something on the news about a young man that got pulled over and got into an altercation with an officer and ended up dying because the officer shot him for whatever reason. I don't know how the altercation escalated that quickly. But at the end of the day, the young man died over a traffic warrant, a traffic warrant. He had missed a court date and had a warrant. So at the end of the day, this kid dies because he was speeding one day and didn't go to a court date.
Mm-hmm.
That's why he died. So I was like, man, this is so messed up. Yeah. And I'm trying to always, you know, like my mindset now is I always try to understand how people think. Like, why do they, at the end of the day, like, man, I would be scared too if someone pulled me over and they go, hey, you have a warrant. You're going to jail. And I'm going to tow your car. And it's going to cost $1,000. Like, people have anxiety. People don't trust it. Like, I always try to think this way. I was like, man, like, how do we de-escalate the situation over something so silly as a traffic warrant? And we have this huge database. Police departments have this database where they can look up your name and they can find your address and your phone number and your relatives and all this stuff. And I was like, man, like, everyone doesn't have the privilege or, you know, the insight to, like, always, you know, make it to court. Like, sometimes they just miss their court date because they had to suddenly move or something happens or whatever. I said, what if there's a way to, like, just reach out to people and remind them, like, hey, you missed your court date. You have a warrant now. And then the other layer of it, I was like, man, like, I'm looking at this warrant list and it's all young people. It's all young males and females, like 19, 20, 24. Like, and I'm looking up their addresses. I'm like, oh, they still live at home. I was like, I'm just going to call their mom. Because if mom finds out, you know, I call mom. I go, hey, Mrs. So-and-so, I'm Officer Alam with this police department. I just want to let you know your son has a warrant for his arrest.
Right.
And she freaks out. She goes, what do you mean? And, you know, I'm the bad guy. But she's like, what do you mean he has a warrant? But I go, hey, and this is how you turn the tables in the sense, like, you know, you de-escalate the situation. I go, ma'am, I don't want him getting pulled over on the street and having, you know, have him freak out about it. I'd rather you bring him to the police station so we can just process him and give him a new court date. And that way, you know your son's safe and we'll get away. You bring him to the police station and I promise you I'll walk him right back out to you. So now mom goes, like, I'm not going to have my child show up on the news. I'm going to bring him to the police station, deal with this, and we're going to go back home. You know, so, like, it's just a way of, like, thinking outside the box. Like, okay, I know traditionally police officers are supposed to go out there and find these guys. Like, why not just call them? Hey, do you know you have a warrant? No, I didn't know I have a warrant. Yeah, man, you got a warrant. So instead of getting, you know, pulled over and getting your car towed and paying all these fines and bills, just come in and we'll give you a new court date. Oh, okay. So what happened was I was doing this, and, like, the chief actually made fun of me about it. And I thought it was a brilliant idea. I was like, hey, man, like, you know, I'm being smart about it. I'm de-escalating situations. Like, people are turning themselves in. And he goes, back in my day, you know, we'd go out there, we'd grab them all. We didn't have to call their moms. And I was like, what? You know, so yeah. One thing, you know, obviously, and I had choice words back to him about it. I was like, well, back in your day, you know, you treated people a certain way, and that this is not cool. So ever since that, me and this guy, we just never got along. We never saw it. I don't wish to talk bad on anybody, but he's not someone that whose opinion I value very much. So when the WWE came calling and I found out the start date, I was like, you know what? For my own safety, rather than telling them that, hey, I'm leaving, because I felt like if I told them I was leaving, I was setting myself up. Like, they're going to mess with me somehow, you know?
Right.
I was like, I'm going to do my last tour of duty. I'm going to turn in all my stuff respectfully. I'll give them all their equipment back, give them all my credentials, my badge, put it in a nice box. On my last tour of duty, I walked in his office, put a note on it, put it on his desk, and I was gone.
And that was it.
Yeah.
Last couple questions for you, because obviously you made the right decision. You had a hometown show the other day, kind of in a real main event position, and I saw a clip where it looked like you grabbed your daughter out of the crowd. How was that for you to play... do Chicago in such a huge position with your family in the crowd?
Man, it's kind of like the same deal when I showed up to SmackDown. They go, hey, you're wrestling Daniel Bryan, you know?
Right.
I'm like, oh, okay. I show up to Allstate Arena, you know, and like, this is my hometown, and I'm thinking, like, oh, maybe, you know, maybe I'll be the opening match. Maybe, like, I don't know what I'll have. Maybe it'll be something. And, you know, they come out with a run sheet, and they go, hey, you're doing Miz TV. See with the Miz, and then, you know, it's going to turn, and then it's a triple threat steel cage match for the WWE Championship. And I'm like, what is going on? Like, when is the big rib finally going to be revealed? We were just kidding the whole time. Like, and I'm just trying to process it. Like, Aiden English is a good friend of mine, and he's from Chicago as well. So I run to him. I was like, he's like, dude, run with the ball. He's like, just run with it. You know, he's like, if they see something in you, like, you know, he's kind of like making slapping sense into me, like, have some confidence about it.
Right,
man. I know when it's game time, like, I'm going to put my game face on him and, you know, and do it. But like, for a moment, you're like, holy hell, this is really cool. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. You're in a cage match. And I was like, yeah, you know, so, I mean, what a wild night. And like, obviously, if there's ever a town, you know, that, you know, you can't go wrong, it's Chicago, because you're from Chicago, they got your back, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a very, very cool night. But yeah, like, this is the second time my daughter's been able to come to like Allstate Arena. But she's at that point now where like she remembers everything. So that show just happened, you know, Wednesday, and you know, before I started talking to you today, Chris, I, you know, I was FaceTime here, and she called me Baba. She goes, hey Baba, do you remember when, and she starts talking about Allstate Arena, like, this Wednesday. Do you remember when Becky Lynch said hi to me? And do you remember when you picked me up? And do you remember when I waved at everyone and they waved? Like, she's remembering this stuff
That's
now.
Great.
So I was telling my wife, I was like, man, I always want her to, like, you know, like, I just want her to know, like one, like, what I see, like, how cool it is to be out there. But there's, if you go back and watch the clip, my wife is bringing her up to the guardrail. And if you look in my daughter's eyes, the way she's looking at me, man, I felt like Superman.
Yeah,
she's looking at me like so amazed, like, that's my dad. Like, he's so cool. And I was like, man, like, it wasn't the react. Like, you always got to find like the little moments that mean the most to you. And like, I always tell my wife, I was like, did you see her eyes? Did you see her eyes? Like, she looked at me like I was King Kong. Like, I was the man, you know, like, this is like, you know, he's Superman. I was like, that's, like, I don't know, man. Like, I came back, I was like, that's what was cool for me, you know? Like, the way she looked at me that way. So, yeah, man, what a cool moment. Something that, you know, hopefully she'll look on, you know, years from now, like, fondly, you know? That, like, you know, like, you know, even though my dad's in his hometown, it's a cool moment for him. He's like, no, let me share this with my
right.
kid, you know?
That's right. That's so cool, man. The last question for you. What's your favorite match you've ever had, and who do you think is the most underrated on 205 Live?
Favorite match I've ever had. I hope this doesn't sound like a cliche response, but I don't think I've had it yet. And
nice.
The reason I'm saying that is because, as you know, the WWE style is so unique in the sense of what it really means to be a good performer.
Mm-hmm.
So I've had like, oh man, this came off real well, or the story came off real well, or the spot came off real well, or I did really well selling. I don't think I've had that match that's been the perfect mixture of both. And I know Sammy was Sammy's name was recently on the show, and you know, he always talks about how he rambles and this and that, but the best piece of advice he gave me one time, I was talking to him about a bunch of things like characters and matches, and he's like, what people don't realize here in WWE is you can go out anywhere in any company and you can have these crazy five-star matches and you can do all this stuff and you're kind of like, you don't have chains on you. He's like, the trick in WWE is to do it within this confined little box.
Yeah.
He's like, that's the art. He goes, we're going to give you this much time and you can't go to the outside and you can't use these moves and you can't have this finish and you can't work this body part. Like, you know, you just keep chipping away, but still this needs to be awesome and you need to get a great reaction and you need to put this guy over and you need to do it in 6 minutes. He goes, that's the art. You know, so to me, if I'm being, you know, not, this isn't me trying to be like, oh, humble. It's like, this is me just being real. Like, I don't think I'm at that point right now where I figure out the perfect concoction of that. Like, what's the combination? You know, how much is too much? Because sometimes my match might be too many stunts, you know, like, oh man, these guys are tearing it up, but it's, you know, it's a car crash. Or this one's like, oh, this one was a little slow. The selling was great, but it was a little slow. You know, like, I'm trying to figure out, you know, what's the perfect balance of this. I don't think I've had my best match yet. Obviously, I'm trying each night, but I'm still working on it.
Right.
But yeah, when Sammy said that, I was like, man, it's right, because people don't realize, like, we have to make magic, but we're not free to do whatever.
Right,
yeah. You know?
There's a lot of rules and restrictions of what you have to do for
sure. Yeah, yeah. And it's not like they're doing it to, like, mess with you. No. They're doing it for the presentation of the show. Like, people don't, like, that's one thing I've learned now that, like, especially on 205, when I would get, like, my segment or my promo, I'd ask the writer, like, can I see, like, the whole run sheet, like, the entire show? Like, I want to know what's going on in everyone's matches.
Mm-hmm.
So I go, oh, if they're doing this, like, why are we going to get even close to that? Let's go the complete opposite direction.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
So, like, that's one thing I learned on that. As far as, like, the most underrated on 205, like, man, like, the entire show is, you know, but if you're going to twist my arm and pick one, I really feel like, it's not just because I've known him for a long time. I really think, like, Arya Daivari is severely underrated. When you look at it, like, he gets it. You know what I mean? Like, his look, his presentation, he's the easiest guy I've worked with, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But, like, to me, I see dollar signs on him. You know what I mean? Like, me, as, like, being in the ring with him, I was like, he gets so much heat, and he's so good. He's like, you know that guy that just, like, he's got that intensity, and he looks like he's ripping your head off?
Right.
But he's got that. And I'm always like, man, I really wish that, like, the writers and the producers would see that. And, like, him and I have gone to bat for each other 1,000 times to try to, like, do something together. It just doesn't work out. But, like, he's finally doing something with, like, Hideo Itami now. And I'm really hoping that they see, like, but he's good on the mic. He can work. He's got that. And I think he's the biggest, like, not even just, like underrated. Like something's going to happen for him to, like, get their eyes on him. Because I really feel like if they pay close attention to him, they would see what everyone else sees. Like, everyone on the roster is like, man, Arya is, like, severely underrated.
Well, the thing too, now that you've kind of broken through into SmackDown regular main event guy for the, you know, at the moment with getting a push, I'm sure it won't be the first, because they'll know they've got a whole cachet of guys down there who are underrated and ready to do more. So, but dude, congratulations on everything. And like I said, man, you just never know what's going to happen, and it's happened for you. And just keep on kicking ass. It's been very, very cool to see.
Yeah, man, and obviously, like, Chris, one, thank you for, you know, taking the time to, you know, let me hop on the show. But, like, if I could give one message to people out there, like, there's so many people, and this isn't just people, like, you know, on the wrestling scene. This is anybody in life. Like, if you got something, man, like, chase it. Like, I'm the same way. I didn't think it would happen. I would close my eyes, and I would see this great dream of performing at WrestleMania and winning the championship and wrestling my, and then I'd open my eyes and, you know, like, you know, reality was set. I had to get to my job. I had to take care of my kids. You know, like, real life gets in the way, and I get that. But, like, if you close your eyes and you still see it, you got to chase it.
Words to live by, man. I believe in that 1,000%. So, Mustafa, congratulations, man, and continued success. And we're looking forward to see what happens to you over the next few weeks, months, and years.
Yeah, man. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Cheers, dude. All right, man. Have a good show tonight. Thanks.
Thank you, brother.
All right, thank you so much to Mustafa Ali. Interesting to see what he does in the Royal Rumble. It's always good to see a new top guy break on through to the other side. And like I said, I am not going to be in the Royal Rumble because I am now officially signed with All Elite Wrestling, and I'm going to tell the whole story about that on Wednesday. Chris Jericho's journey to All Elite Wrestling. It's been a long one with lots of ups and downs and close calls, and you'll find out everything that you want to know. If you're saying, why is Jericho in AEW? This is exciting. I'm excited, or I don't want to deal with this. I want him in WWE. I'm going to tell you the whole story, and we're going to get it done on Wednesday. Have a great weekend. In the meantime and in between time, stay hard, stay cool, stay hungry. Peace, love, and hugs, and a big yeah, boy. Oh, yeah.
The Westwood One Podcast Network.